funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
From the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C., this is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. I am not a fearless person, but I'm lucky enough to have spoken with many people who seem to be. Members of the military, doctors and nurses caring for desperately ill, dangerously infectious patients during the Ebola outbreak, National Geographic photographers who think nothing of diving to the depths of an icy ocean or climbing to the top of a great sequoia to capture the perfect shot. But there's another kind of courage that interests me even more, and that is the kind it takes to be freaked out like any normal person at the thought of going into a war zone or attending a street protest that threatens to spiral out of control and turn violent, and then going anyway. We're very happy to begin our week of live broadcasts here in Washington, D.C., with someone who has made a career of this kind of human-scale bravery, of going to dangerous places, getting to know the people who live there, and sticking around long enough to tell their stories.
Okay, there's police in riot gear. We're all running. Oh, that's tear gas. Oh, my God.
So where are the regime troops and where are the rebels? Another shell comes in. Noor keeps working as if nothing happened.
That was NPR's Kelly McEvers reporting for NPR from various places in the Middle East. Last year, she was named a co-host of NPR's flagship afternoon news magazine, All Things Considered. But she had an idea to do more. And last month, she launched her new podcast series, Embedded, in which she and her colleagues go deep to get to the stories shorter reports have to trim away and take the incredibly bold step of confessing their own fears and frustrations along the way. Kelly McEvers is former Beirut bureau chief for NPR who covered the Arab Spring and the conflict in Syria. She has told the stories of a smuggler in Dubai, a sex worker in Azerbaijan, and a pirate off the coast of Malaysia. Her many commendations include Gracie, DuPont Columbia, and Peabody Awards, and I am delighted she could be with us today. Kelly, welcome back to Think.
Thanks for having me.
The idea of going so much deeper into a story that we all think we know is so compelling, because by its nature, journalism is as much about what we have to leave out of a story as what goes in.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, I was a freelancer for a really, really long time. And part of the way you do that job is you read all the headlines and all the stories about something that you're currently reporting on. And you figure out, like, well, what's missing? You know, you're always trying to figure out, like, what's missing? How can I fill in the blanks? Because you're a freelancer. You have to eat. So you have to find a way to, like, pay the bills. And so I think that's just, like, this instinct that I still have. You know, there's a story. Like, for instance, you know, the shootout in Waco, Texas, right? We saw the headlines. We saw the pictures on TV, you know, a bunch of bikers hanging out at a restaurant on a Sunday afternoon. And you just, you always have a lot of questions. I know that I have a lot of questions whenever I see a news story like that. And so I wanted to figure out how to do something that would try to answer some of those questions and hope that they're the same questions, you know, that our listeners have too.
So what was widely reported on the Waco shootout wasn't exactly wrong. There was just a lot of nuance that got lost.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. It's not like I have questions because I think everybody is completely wrong and I'm going to do it right. It's like, man, there seems like there's so many holes in the story. And of course, we're not going to be able to fill in all of those blanks until there's a trial, perhaps, if there ever is a trial in that case, or multiple trials. Who knows how all that's really going to be solved? Or maybe we never really will know all of the details. But it sure is interesting and fun, honestly, to go try to answer some more of those questions and get closer to them than we have so far. And in doing that, I think part of what you can do in a podcast that you can't necessarily do on a more straight news program is to tell people about that process, right? It's like, come along with me, you know, while we go try to figure this out. Take my hand. Let's go to Texas and see what we can see and see who we can meet and see what they tell us.
So that can-do spirit doesn't necessarily make it easy for you to find people to talk to.
Right, exactly.
We message Banditos on Facebook, but get no response. We find out about a Bandito fundraiser at a bar. We don't have a guy to get us in, but we try anyway.
Hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Hi.
Where are y'all? What do you need?
We are with NPR, National Public Radio.
Yes.
We heard about the meeting. Just kind of wanted to come check it out.
Well, it's a private party. It's $10 to get in, and we don't do any video or audio recording in our parties. So if that's a problem, well, that's too bad.
Even outside?
Even outside, because this whole area is our private party.
So the whole area is their private party.
Right. Yeah,
but you exactly. had $10, so you went in.
Yeah, so we went in. So we put our recording equipment in the trunk, and we went in and hung out for a while and like, you know, watched the band play. I actually, at one point, there was a raffle drawing, because it was a fundraiser. So you paid your $10 and you got tickets. And then at one point they were going to do a raffle drawing, so they asked me to come up on the stage and draw one of the tickets, where I was like totally trying to not bring too much attention to myself, but it was kind of obvious that we were not, you know, it's like the game of like one of these things is not like the other. Two NPR reporters at a Bandido fundraiser. We definitely stuck out. But yeah, I mean, the idea was to go, and yeah, they're not going to go on the record, but we learned some stuff being in there that day. We learned a little bit just about the dynamic between... You know, we learned first, you know, how closed and how serious about being closed the Bandidos are. I mean, this is the dominant biker group in Texas, you know, the subject of multiple federal investigations. You know, they've got their story on lockdown. They don't talk to people. That was interesting to see how that plays out. It was also interesting to see these so-called support clubs that operate, you know, they put this SYLB, support your local Bandidos, patches on their vests, and sort of just what that means and how you could just see the hierarchy at work just in this, like, this one little bar. So yeah, it was totally worth going, even though it was slightly humiliating.
Part of what's exciting and I guess risky about what you're doing is that you're capturing stuff in real time. You're not swooping in after the fact, knowing that a story happened and then piecing it back together.
How
do you manage your expectations about what it is you hope to get and what actually occurs with the microphone out?
I mean, I think you have to just give in to the fact that you can't plan for it. You know, I think there's great podcasts and tons of great radio out there when you are, you know, you're sitting in a studio and you're sort of recreating a story. You know, you're saying, all right, let's get the perfect voice and really take the time to sort of craft a conversation that's going to spin out this narrative in this wonderful way. And I love listening to that stuff all the time. I just happen to like to be out in the world also. But it's harder to then construct a story. You have to just sort of understand that, like, whatever unfolds on tape is what you got. And so you have to be okay with the fact that maybe sometimes nothing's going to happen for a while. In this particular story, you know, it took us days and days and days before we were able to get any kind of access. As you could hear, we got very little access to the Bandidos at all. We did get some access to the other biker club that was involved in the shootout, the Cossacks. But it took time. And so, I mean, I think on other stories, we've just sort of showed up and we get lucky and we end up, you know, having a certain level of access. But this was more, you know, it took more patience. And so you have to kind of check the usual planning instinct that you have when you're working on a quicker news deadline, where you're just like, all right, we're going to get in, we're going to get the thing, and then we got to get out and file. You have to be able to say, like, all right, it's day three, we still don't have everything, but, you know, I think we'll get something if we just persevere. It's harder.
Yeah, the luck thing really is a factor, right? Because you can work as hard as you possibly can and things don't always turn out perfectly, or... Yeah. You can stumble upon something that is really transcendent.
Right. Totally. Yeah. And that's what happened in this case, you know, with the Cossacks. We were calling so many people, going through public records, you know, people that had been arrested in Waco that day and later charged, and then cross-checking that with, you know, phone records and address records. And we were going door to door, knocking on, you know, we were going to people's workplaces. Like, we were looking all over the place for access to this club. And eventually, and we were putting out messages on social media, and eventually it was a guy messaging. No, I friended a guy on Facebook who we had known, and I can't really tell you why because we don't want to reveal his identity, but we had sort of known that he was affiliated with the Cossacks, and we sent him a message and he kind of says, you know, who are you? And kind of puts me through several tests before I actually get to meet him, and then before he like actually introduces us. It's a very slow process, but yeah, it was kind of a lucky shot on Facebook that got us in.
Were there NPR listeners among the Bandidos and the Cossacks? Did they know who you were?
That is a great question. I'm sure, yeah, people totally knew who we were. There's a scene in this particular episode where we're spending some time in a Cossack clubhouse in a town in eastern Texas, and there are many remarks made about politics other things that, you know, and they're kind of ribbing us basically for working for NPR and for being, you know, urbanites.
I've heard you studiously avoid using the word gang in our conversation
yeah.
and in the piece.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, gang is, it's a criminal affiliation to some degree. And, you know, the feds do consider the Bandidos a gang. They consider the Cossacks an emerging gang. I mean, this is, you know, we avoided using it because it is a very much, in the context of this story, it's very much a criminal affiliation. And that's not something we wanted to put in our own words. And so when we did talk about them, we would say, well, the feds consider them this or this. But otherwise, you know, they themselves, especially the Cossacks, who we spent a lot of time with, would say up and down over and over, we are a club. We are not a gang. This isn't us. We're not, this isn't who we are. We don't deal drugs. We don't run prostitution. We don't kill people. You know, that's what they told us. And so we tried to kind of, you know, toe the line. When they're speaking in their voice, that's how they talk about themselves. When authorities are speaking about them, we attribute it as such.
The modern connotation of an embedded journalist is someone traveling with the military to try and
right.
understand on the ground what's really happening. That's been groundbreaking, but it's also been criticized by people who are worried that reporters are identifying
right.
too much with their subjects.
That you get too close, yes. I don't think there was a danger of us getting too close with bikers, as close as much as I wanted to get close.
You did take a ride.
We took a ride for sure. It was really nice. It was really, really nice. I mean, I've ridden on a Harley a few times before, but this was pretty great. And yeah, we went to a couple parties and they're funny and we had a blast. But yeah, I mean, there's always the danger of when you get in too deep. I think this happens to people making documentaries, people who spend years and years on a story or on a book. I mean, you start to lose perspective. You need that the benefit of time to kind of step back and say, okay, what was really happening in this moment? I chose the title Embedded in a way to sort of turn that idea of being embedded in the Middle East with the military on its head. I never did that many embeds when I was in the Middle East. I did probably just a handful. By the time I got to Iraq, it was 2010, and you didn't need to be with the military in order to go out and do real reporting in Iraq. And so my whole thing was I was always kind of, quote, embedded with the people. And so that was my idea with the title of the show. But I think it raises some interesting questions now that it's out there about, well, what does it really mean and why do you want to do it and are you getting too close? And when you get too close, what do you do? What do you say? Luckily, I have am surrounded by amazing journalists and editors who can help me make sure that I haven't lost perspective.
Do you feel yourself getting too close sometimes?
Sure. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Like all the time, every story. I mean, I'm a human being. I can't help it. You can't help but have empathy for the people you're reporting on, whether it's people in Syria, who I reported on for years, or people who are addicted to opioids, who we reported on for another episode of this podcast, or people who live on Skid Row, which is another place we just reported on for the podcast. Yeah, you can't help it. I mean, that's the point, right, of being embedded is like, come with me to a place that you might not have normally thought about going yourself. And I'll show you what I find there. I'm not saying you have to agree with these people. I'm not saying you have to think that everything they're saying is right. But you have to get down in there and listen to them with me. And then you can make your decision.
Kelly McEvers is my guest. She's co-host of All Things Considered and host of the new podcast, Embedded. We will continue our conversation with her in a few minutes. You can follow along this week on social media with the hashtag ThinkInDC. Send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think or call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
From the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C., this is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. We're in Washington all week. You can follow along with the hashtag ThinkInDC. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can email think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. My guest this hour is Kelly McEvers. She is co-host of All Things Considered and host of the new podcast Embedded. Kelly, when you went to Indiana, you spent days hanging out in what amounts to a drug den. What brought you there?
First of all, I probably wouldn't say a drug den. I mean, we were really interested in, again, the headlines, right? HIV outbreak in a small town in Indiana. I mean, HIV outbreak in the United States in 2015. I mean, I think that's one of those headlines. You don't even have to read the story to just be like, wait, what? You know, how? What's going on? How is that possible? How could that happen? And then you read a little further and you hear that it's people who are addicted to this very powerful opioid. It's called Opana. That people were sharing needles. And you say, again, how could that happen? I mean, that was what powered us to go try to answer that question. The house is the name of the episode because we did. We spent a bunch of time in this one house where we met several people who were addicted to this drug and a few of whom were HIV positive. It was actually owned by an older gentleman whose son was one of these addicts and had been diagnosed with HIV. And then by the time we got there, had already left and was in rehab. So the man who owned the house himself, I mean, he was not a drug user. He didn't necessarily condone drug use, but there were just a lot of people kind of hanging around this house who were friends of his son. Who were doing this drug and related to him also in other ways. So people he sort of felt like he couldn't kick out of the house. So it's a little more complicated than just being, you know, I think what people might imagine as like a typical drug house. I mean, this was a very nice house, very clean. And, you know, the older gentleman who owned it, you know, kept a pretty orderly place. But yeah, behind closed doors in the bedrooms is where we were able to talk to people about this and see them doing the drug. We were interested in that because the company that makes this drug actually reformulated the drug a few years ago in order to make it abuse resistant. And at that moment when they reformulated it is actually when people started injecting the drug. So it's this irony, unintended consequence, whatever you want to call it. It was then that people started injecting the drug. Needle exchanges were not legal in the state of Indiana. Actually, possessing a needle was something that you could get arrested for in the state of Indiana. And so people started sharing needles. And then you get high numbers of hepatitis C, which is a really clear indicator that people are sharing needles. And then you have an outbreak of HIV. And so we were able to just trace that story through the actual people who were living it.
We're going to listen here to your time spent watching people as they were injecting this drug. We should let people know before we do that that this may be upsetting to listen to.
This is really intense, yeah. They're really precise about who gets how much, and it all depends on how much money you put on it. So the guy in the bed put the least amount of money down on this pill, so he only gets a little bit. He raises his sleeve, and about 4 inches of one of his veins is this really dark purple color. And on the top is a sore. So he takes the needle and he injects it into the sore. He asks me if I mind.
I don't mind if you don't mind.
But he can't get a vein. So he takes the needle out and takes his hand and sandwiches it between his two legs and like crosses his legs really tight so the veins in his hand will pop out. There's a bunch of little red marks on his hand where he looks like he's shot before. And he sticks the needle into one of those. Joy and Jeff have both turned their backs to me while they're doing their hits. And then it just gets really, really quiet. After about 5 minutes, they wrap up all the gear and hide it. And then come out into the living room, sit down.
It's so easy, Kelly, to dismiss drug addicts, you know, using that word and that phrase in air quotes as scary or bad, and certainly they probably can be, but these people that you introduce us to are real people and they have complicated stories and they're hard to just write off.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, that scene in particular doesn't necessarily tell you all of that. But yeah, I mean, when we spend enough time, as we get to in a podcast, giving you their backgrounds and telling you where they come from. And one was an Iraq war veteran who hurt his back when his Humvee rolled over in Iraq. He came back. He was prescribed opioids by a doctor in the Veterans Administration system. He became addicted. And then when, you know, he switched prescriptions to one of these so-called pill mills. These are places where doctors will prescribe opioids for cash. That ran out, you know, and then you start buying on the street. I mean, it's a story we know in the opioid crisis, but to actually hear it told step by step by someone and to really kind of understand the slippery slope that you can get on and get addicted to these drugs, I think it at least makes me pause and think, huh, I wonder if this, you know, if all of the responsibility for this rests with this one individual, or if there's something a little bit bigger at work here, if there's different points along the way where we as a society can ask some questions about how things work and should they be changed.
Of course, when you're talking to officials, you apply judgment and skepticism. You do the same when you're talking to regular people. What do you do as you report these long-form pieces with the problem of the unreliable narrator or subject, the person who may be telling you their version of the truth, but it's not objectively correct?
We do what we do with everybody. We fact check, you know, we corroborate. Somebody tells us a story. Oh, this one night we were at this house and we were arrested with this guy. We go ask that other guy, was he there? We go check the police records. Were they there? We ask the prosecutor. We ask the public defenders. We look in the public record and see what's available. We do what we do with everyone. We do journalism, you know.
I've thought about this approach and the story of Ahmed Mohammed. I remember him, the ninth grader from Irving, Texas, who was arrested for the bomb that the device that looked like a bomb that he brought to school. And it turns out it was not. But the moment that story was released, everybody had these incredibly strong opinions. There were just little bits of information available. And yet people felt like they had enough to make a judgment and argue back and forth.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about this so much when I was listening to one of my favorite podcasts, which is Serial. The second season of Serial was all about Bo Bergdahl, right? And such a fascinating story, right? And we all, like so many people, made up their minds about Bo Bergdahl, one way or the other. Good guy, bad guy, you know, and everywhere in between. But it's one of those stories. And when you got to the end of that season, what was so interesting was they really unpacked this one moment where everybody, you know, people in America, veterans in particular, had made up their mind that six people died trying to save Bo Bergdahl. There was even a T-shirt made about it, right? And they went on TV and they talked about it as if it was just true. And, you know, Serial then takes like an hour, basically, of radio, which is based probably on weeks of reporting, to just unpack that one thing. And that just made me think so much. I mean, first of all, when I listen, I'm like, viva journalism. You know, thank gosh that people like want to listen to this stuff. And we get to keep doing journalism because we can. This happens every day. People going on TV or the radio and the newspaper saying something based on a tiny little fact. And that fact might not actually even be true. You know, what a great world it is that there is this place where people want to listen to people like me and Sarah Koenig and all these other journalists reporting stuff out so you can sort of expand that little factoid and see what's behind it.
So I know you're not going to share your opinions publicly, but I wonder how your understanding through your work that there is always more to the story affects your tendency to form any kind of opinion based on anything that's been reported by anybody else.
I mean, there's always more to the story. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if it's about an opinion, right? It's just about like knowing from doing this job for so long. I mean, I've actually been a journalist for a really long time. And just, you know, like, just knowing from experience that every single time you go out, you're going to find more. That definitely drives me more than whether I'm going to, you know, have an opinion about something or not, you know, or whether I'm going to, like, I mean, we live in this echo chamber right now where we're, you know, the more time we spend online, the more time we know we spend with people who think like us, you know. So I am not interested in living in an echo chamber where everybody's just going to affirm everything I say, like, oh, great opinion, great idea. You know, I want to live in a world where it's constant opposition and conflict with my own idea. Like, I, you know, I'm, of course, will go into something with an idea, but I love when it's totally contradicted.
What got you thinking about making this series so transparent?
I don't know. I think because people – I think it's something that people have responded to, right? I think that's one of the things about podcasts that's so cool. People are choosing to put you in their ear and listen to you at a certain time of day, like whether it's during a commute, a bike ride, while they're doing the dishes. It's different than just turning on the radio and saying, well, whatever comes on, comes on. A podcast is like, I have decided – that I want this person in my ear, right up close to my brain for the next 35 minutes. And so I think you have to just be a little more human. I think you just have to be a little more like, all right, here's how it happened. Like I said, take my hand, come along with me. And I think that nowadays, I think we're in an era where authenticity is extremely important to listeners, viewers, readers, clickers, you know. And so I think just being really honest and transparent without trying to sound too self-important, I think it's important to people. And so, I mean, it's also just how I like to work. So, you know, the more we've done it, the more people have responded to it. So we'll keep doing it.
Why do you think it's considered a weakness traditionally for journalists to admit to being anything other than omniscient by the time the deadline rolls around?
I honestly think it's a question of style and form. There was a time in our lives where we wanted Walter Cronkite to know everything. And that is fine. You know, like, there are times in my life when I still need that too. You know, in big, important, breaking stories about national security, I mean, there's times when an anchor, a serious anchor, is somebody you want and need. You need to know that there's somebody who's, like, considered all the bases and who is really smart and who has, you know, been working on this for 35 years. You need that. Like, it is really important. I'm not saying that that should just go away. But I think there's also, we know now, there's also this hunger for a person who can admit that they have faults and that they make mistakes. And so that you can come along with them, too, while you're trying to puzzle out something.
This sounds really different, too, different from traditional documentaries. It's so easy to write narration that does not sound like talking, but like writing. Mm-hmm. You know, I was thinking about, you know, the phrase, like, the 23-year-old Martinez says opening her own restaurant is a dream come true. Roll soundbite. You would never say that to your best friend if you were telling her about.
Never say that to your best friend.
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
And I don't think it's just in a podcast. I think it's in any broadcast medium anywhere. We should talk like ourselves, you know. But the funny thing is and this, I realized this when I got this new job hosting All Things Considered. You know, I said this to a friend at one point. I was like, I had no idea how hard it was going to be to sound like myself. He was like, what are you talking about? And I'm like, well, you get in this chair and you're in this thing and you're playing this music and, you know, it's the big story of the day and you feel like you should sound all, like, important and stuff. And you should, but you should also, like, use words that you would actually use when you're talking to, like, your friends and family. And so, although my mom, you know, she'll get me sometimes because she hears me doing interviews and she's like, you say like too much. You say, you know what I mean, too much and all this stuff. I'm like, well, that's how I talk. I'm sorry. But, you know, I think so. I don't know if it's – I don't think it's necessarily a podcast where that's true. I think we should try to sound like ourselves. I think there's this kind of news writing tendency, whether it's in newspapers or in broadcast, that we should all try to break all the time.
Do you find yourself pushing back against those conventions when
totally.
You are anchoring?
Yeah, totally. I mean, but that's like anchoring. Like, we're always like, it's the beautiful thing about working on a show, like All Things Considered, is like, it's this team. Like, everything is a collaboration, every single segment, you know? And so, like, the words that come out of my mouth is like a collaboration with a bunch of people. So there's always, you know, a conversation about, like, should we say it like this? Should we say it like this? Should we say it like this? But I think my general position in those conversations is like, I probably wouldn't say it like that to my friends, you know? And so it's like, I think I would say it like this. And they're like, well, you can't say that. Why don't you try that? You know, and so it's pretty cool.
How do you toggle back and forth between the pace of working on something like Embedded, this deep dive, and the multiple daily topics that you have to bone up for in order to do All Things Considered?
It's kind of cool because it's kind of like one breeds another. You know, I sit down at a table with all these great colleagues from All Things Considered every day. And what do? We consider all things. We consider the news of the day, which we love to joke about. But I mean, we'd like, you know, I'm sitting with all these amazingly smart people and we're all talking about the news of the day. And it's there a lot of times. And I'm like, huh, I wonder if that's something we need to consider more deeply. Like, you know, sometimes it's like, yeah, that's something we need to get this guy on the line. We need to ask him four really smart, really pointed questions. And that's the thing people need to hear today. But then sometimes it's like, huh, yeah, we should do that conversation, but maybe we should also take a dive, you know? So, I mean, I think one, they feed each other, you know? I think that, yes, but in the, like, the workflow, it's insane. You know, I'll finish, like, three interviews for The Daily Show, and I might have, like, an hour and a half break on my calendar, and then I'll be able to just, like, sit down, put the headphones on, close my eyes, and, like, listen to a draft of an upcoming episode of Embedded and just slow down and make notes and talk about signposts and how it should be mixed. And, you know, like, it's a little slower than the pace of the day. And, yeah, it's definitely switching between two roles. Rapidly, but so far it's working out okay.
Is it instantly apparent to you when a story deserves that deeper treatment, or are there some that kind of stick with you and you just can't let them go?
Yeah, it's not instantly apparent. Sometimes, I mean, the first several pieces in this season of this podcast were suggestions from other people. There was a time when we thought, oh, we could do it weekly and then we'll have listeners suggest where we should go. And then we realized, oh, that's logistically impossible. Like, how could we possibly do that? But it'd be so cool, right? And we still want listeners to suggest where we should go, especially if we start to think about a second season. But yeah, so I mean, I started just kind of polling friends and colleagues, mostly people in the newsroom. So the idea to do the Waco shootout was actually from a colleague here in the newsroom at NPR West.
My guest is Kelly McEvers, co-host of All Things Considered and host of the new podcast Embedded. We will continue our conversation in a couple of minutes. You can call us at 1-800-933-5372. Email think@kera.org. Find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, where you can follow along all week on social media with the hashtag ThinkInDC.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA from the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C. all week. You can follow along with the hashtag ThinkInDC. My guest today is Kelly McEvers. She's co-host of All Things Considered and host of the new podcast Embedded. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Kelly, a lot of people have heard the very wide reporting about how newsroom budgets in many places are shrinking and staff is shrinking. The other thing that, you know, the stress that people may not realize is that time is at a premium in a way that it never has been before. Can you talk about what you've discovered about the value of quantity time in reporting, where you could get the facts in a couple of hours, but you decide you want to stick around?
I mean, like I said, I think there is value in both. There is value in being on top of a story. There is value, I think, back to the San Bernardino shootings that happened here near where I am at NPR West. That was a story that, you know, after we reported the initial reports on All Things Considered, we jumped and drove out there and spent a couple, you know, those first days on the ground. There's a lot of value in that. You know, there's a lot of value in, like, calling up your newsroom and saying, look, we've got this person. Let's go with this interview in 20 minutes and turning it around and cutting it and getting on the air, because people want to know. People need the facts, and they need them. They need to know that they are reliable facts in the moment of a breaking story. And so I think that, you know, as we think about news budgets there, and as NPR thinks about news budgets, there's a ton of value in being that reliable voice in that moment when something happens. And frankly, being live, you know, more often sometimes. And we're thinking about that a lot at NPR. But yeah, then there's also this instinct to say there's sometimes, and there's some stories that really warrant a bigger take. I mean, we are in the midst of an opioid crisis in this country. And in one tiny little community, that led to an HIV outbreak. I think that was us and editors saying, well, let's take a minute or two or 6 days, as it turned out, on the ground of reporting to see what happened. But if you think about it, really, 6 days, that's not that long. You know, we're not talking about a 10-year Making a Murderer project, right, of like a documentary film project that goes on for that long. It's really just 6 days. And it doesn't actually take that much money or that much time to do that kind of reporting. But it takes editors and news executives, frankly, to say we're committed to it. And, you know, I'm lucky enough to work at one of those places that is.
It's one thing when you interview someone who's got a project that they're pushing or a book, or they are a public official. When you talk to real people, certainly they have the ability to give you their consent, but they may not entirely understand how participating in something like this might change their lives. So you have to think about that for them.
We're very, very, very clear about this. We have lots of discussions with our editors and with our lawyers about how to have these conversations with people so that we can just be extremely clear. But yeah, you could never completely prepare someone for you know, what kind of impact their story might have. Our opioid episode, we reported some time back, and because it's been a while getting this entire podcast series going, we knew that we were going to release the story about these addicts that we met in Indiana. But we also felt really strongly that we needed to go back and talk to all of them first, see how they were doing, first of all, just so we could have an epilogue to the story. And also, you know, reconnect and say, this is happening. We want you to know, want you to make sure that you're aware of what's going on and sort of the landscape and how this story is going to appeal, is going to appear. We felt really strongly about that. We actually ended up like having a listening event in Indianapolis and inviting people from the community to come and talk about it beforehand as well. So, I mean, we were very aware of that, especially on that particularly sensitive subject. But it's something we're extremely aware of in the moment as we're talking to people. Like, this is who we are. This is who we work for. This is where this story is going to appear. I'm recording. Is that okay? I mean, you're just in a constant state of inform and consent.
Knowing that at any moment that could cause them to say, actually, that's not okay. Please turn off your recorder.
Absolutely. Totally. And people say that all the time. And you're like, sure, I'll turn it off. You're in control. You're in charge here. You know, I am not, we are not in the business of tricking people into talking to us. Like, that's just not good journalism. Like, I'm not interested in somebody, in hearing somebody who doesn't know they're going to be recorded or doesn't totally understand the circumstances under which they're being recorded.
Talk about the value of time when you were reporting among women in sex-segregated societies. You've written about this recently. The time that
in
you
the Middle
spent,
East.
Yeah, the time that you spent gave you perspective that you wouldn't have had otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, people always, 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 always ask me, what was it like to be a woman in the Middle East? It must have been terrible. It's a place where they treat women horribly. And so therefore, you know, and I always say, no, it's the opposite. It was fantastic to work as a woman in the Middle East. And the problem, I think, with that question, I think, is and I always kind of kick myself because it's like, dang it, I didn't do a good enough job of telling the story of the Middle East if people still think this, is this thing, this idea that everywhere in the entire Middle East, you know, societies are completely conservative and gender, you know, people are kept segregated by their gender. Just not true, you know. True in a lot of Saudi Arabia, true in many villages, I'm told, in Afghanistan. I've never actually worked there. Not true in huge parts of Iraq, Syria, none of Lebanon, you know, lots and lots of countries where I spent a lot of time and worked. And so that's one thing, you know, sort of just debunking that that idea, and just trying to explain that there's this spectrum, right? It's like, yes, on one end you've got the very, very conservative village where men and women are kept separately and where women don't drive and where women are covered head to toe and are not allowed to vote and don't work, you know. And then on the other end of the spectrum you have like women walking down the beach in bikinis and, you know, and outside of Beirut in Lebanon. So and just sort of talking about how it's everything in between, I think, is important. On the one hand. On the other hand, in the places where it was conservative and where there were sort of more traditional values at play, as a woman, I was able to access everybody, right? I could go to the part of the house where just the women and the children were, and I could go to the part of the house where the men were because I was a foreign woman, and so the rules didn't apply to me, right? So I had kind of the best of both worlds on any story that I was ever reporting. So again, that's the kind of thing you just can't... It's nuanced and it's super difficult. I mean, just the question of women covering their hair, or covering their face, or covering their bodies is very nuanced. It depends completely on what country you're in, and it has a historical context that I think gets lost a lot of times here in the West. And it's something that I would talk about until I'm blue in the face, honestly. But, you know, I mean, it's just a lot more difficult and complicated than we think it is. And so, again, that's like the kind of question you can only really answer if you go in and spend the time and talk to people.
Surely this is oversimplifying, but would it be equivalent to people in other countries thinking every young woman in the United States wants to be a Kardashian?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah. My friends in Iraq were always like, my dear, dear colleagues in Iraq have this, I know, who haven't visited the U.S. One in particular I'm thinking of, he has this vision of us, yeah, that everyone's walking down the street in a bikini and that we're all like, we've all at one time or maybe currently are doing drugs and that, like, you know, like everyone's sleeping with everyone else. You know, I mean, there's just this like, yeah, I mean, if you based your judgment of America only on Hollywood movie depictions of America, you would have kind of a skewed vision. And so, yeah, it's similar.
So for all things considered, all the other anchors are based here in D.C. You're based at NPR West in Culver City. Mm-hmm. Talk about the collaboration and communication and how that works with you being in a remote location.
I'm sitting in the studio right now and have this huge TV screen or like computer screen that's a monitor, let's say, huge. And during the show, I can see our director, who is the person who, you know, kind of points to me and tells me when it's time to go. There's also a clock and there's a light and there's all these visual cues to tell me when I have to go. And there's also somebody talking in my ear saying, go, when it's time to go, because there's a slight delay. So if I was watching only the monitor, then I wouldn't know the precise second to go. So technically, we have it all sorted out here in the studio, like while we're live broadcasting the show. Every morning, you know, we Skype in and have a Skype video conference meeting. That's how I and my colleagues here at NPR West join up with the meeting in Washington. And then basically, yeah, we're on like instant messenger and the telephone and email all day long. I mean, we're just, it's this huge team. Like I said, everything we do is like a collaboration. So I'm just like constantly picking up my phone and being, hey, okay, writing this thing. Okay, gotta go. Yep, gotta, yep, see you, bye. So yeah.
Do you all build in time for like water cooler moments where you just talk as people?
Sure. Yeah, of course. The meeting's actually great. I mean, it's just the morning meeting. It's like, you know, anybody who works in a newsroom has one, right? The morning meeting where we, you know, talk about the serious news of the day, but we also have a chance to like laugh and toss ideas around, and people come up with crazy ideas that get, you know, that get 86'd, and then we come up with crazy ideas that actually end up on the show. We try to get creative, and, you know, and it's usually right after that meeting that's kind of this, before the day really starts to get away from you, it's this is like about 30 minutes after the meeting where you can kind of shoot the breeze and talk about the day before. You know, how did you feel about the fact that we had four elements about Prince on the day that he died? Did you like the way we did this dead roll? You know, before then the day gets started.
Is there a point at which you feel like you can relax? Is it once the show is over?
No, because then I have to think about the podcast.
Yeah.
Yes, right. Once the show, as soon as the show's over, it's 3 Pacific time. And then, yeah, I spend the next 3 hours usually working on the podcast.
Of course, you're still traveling and you're also working on the podcast. I wonder, though, when you hear about a reporter being dispatched somewhere, if there's a part of you that envies them.
Oh, I still get to be dispatched. Don't get me wrong. Like, if I weren't dispatched every once in a while, You'd be talking to a crazy person right now. No, I love being in the studio. I love talking to the reporters who are dispatched. I just got off the line with right before talking to you with NPR Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman and Middle East correspondent Alice Fordham, who is now based in Beirut, where I used to be, and who's fantastic. I love talking to them. I love hearing the latest. You know, it's fun to be the person in the studio and to ask them what's going on. But every once in a while, I need to get my turn to be dispatched. And I am given that turn, both for the podcast and for All Things Considered. So it's cool. I was in South Sudan like a month ago. So I'm okay.
Do residents of Culver City, California think NPR has put them on the map?
I don't know. You would have to ask. I think I know. Well, I don't think I know that my colleague Melissa Block, who is longtime host of All Things Considered, when they came and hosted the show from here before we had a permanent host based here, I know they interviewed the mayor and talked to him about that and sort of the pride of that Culver City has, at least at the official level for us being here. People know we're here for sure.
How different is the vibe around the NPR West offices?
You know, there's all kinds of jokes about it. Like, like, oh, they all just surf to work and blah, blah, blah. Like, well, they all have the great weather. But, yeah, no, it's cool. It's a little smaller than D.C. It's really diverse here. And so we have just, like, this amazing array of perspectives and ideas. And I really love that. And it's, yeah, it's cool. We all kind of keep East Coast hours, so it's not like we get to be super relaxed.
How much of Embedded is already in the can and how much is still in production?
Whoa, I think we're kind of done with all the stuff that's in the can and everything else is now in progress, which actually means more work than before, which I don't think I have said out loud yet until just now, which makes me kind of terrified. But yeah, we have several episodes coming up. We're going to be in an immigration courtroom for the next episode. We're actually going to return to the house in Indiana, not exactly to the house, but to a character from the house from our first episode. We had a lot of curiosity. People wanted to know what had happened. A lot of people are saying, you know, wait, are you just going to do one episode? I need more. And so we're thinking about revisiting. Well, we're definitely revisiting one of the characters, thinking about revisiting other things. We're going to be with basketball players. We're going to be in South Sudan. We've got lots of good stuff coming up.
How do you know when a story is finished?
Never. I mean, yeah, you don't. You know, you have to sort of, especially with these embedded episodes, we're thinking about them a little more like a documentary in that, you know, it has to, at some point, it just has to be done. But a lot of them, because we did put them to bed a little while ago, we kind of will attach an epilogue at the end. You know, since we've done this reporting, this is what's happened to this character, this police officer, this, you know, this biker club. And so we do it like that. But no, I mean, are you kidding? We have Google alerts for every single, right? I have a Google alert for Skid Row now. I have a Google alert for the Cossacks in Texas. I have a Google alert for Indiana and any sort of public health story that comes out of Indiana. No, stories are never done because life goes on.
Kelly McEvers is co-host of All Things Considered and host of the new podcast Embedded. You can subscribe at NPR One. Kelly, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Really appreciate it.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and executive producer Jeff Whittington. Our team back in Dallas includes Shelley Canavy, Stephanie Kuo, and Tori Whitley. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think and follow along our Think in DC week with the hashtag Think in DC. You can contact us via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.